Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Music of the Church, as it presented itself to people in the Middle Ages and through history. Our guest in the studio this evening is Paul Collins, once sitting in the chair here at the ABC, but these days author and commentator, and most recently the author of The Birth of the West. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, John.
That music betokens, because chant and the way it was put together is a sort of way in which your book is illustrative of that, even though you don't talk about music, because chant did take on its form that it has today in the very period we're talking about.
That's exactly right. It's interesting that most people think that Gregorian chant, you know, an example we've heard, comes from Rome. Well, it actually doesn't. What happened was that Byzantine chant was adopted by the Franks when they were converted to Christianity. They adapted that and transformed it, and in a way, that's what Gregorian was. It then went back to Rome from the Frankish lands.
700 to 1000 AD that we're about to talk about.
That's right.
Well, let's describe your book. Your book outlines the way in which we may say that what we'd describe as the cultural West emerged around 1000 years ago out of the lawless, almost wild borderlands that Europe had become in the centuries following the decline of the Western Roman Empire.
Probably have to go back to 400. In the 5th century, the Roman Empire in the West was in its terminal collapse. So throughout the 300s, the Western Roman Empire was in terrible straits. 407, 408, the Rhine actually froze over. The Roman fleet was incapacitated. They didn't have icebreakers. And so they were unable to hold that frontier. And the tribes on the edge of the Roman Empire in Western Europe, the Franks, there's a whole group of tribes that were there, crossed the frontier. And it wasn't so much an invasion as, I mean, Peter Brown, the great historian of this period, describes it as a gold rush. Because what they saw across the Roman frontier was not just culture, but that they saw the wealth, saw the loot, exactly. So you have then a period from the collapse of the empire in the West right through until really the late 700s, when the Franks emerge as the dominant group among the barbarian tribes, particularly with a man like Charles Martel, who defeated the Moorish invasion, the Islamic invasion of Europe, at the so-called Battle of Tours. And then from that kind of line that comes from Charles Martel, you have these guys who are the mayors of the palace for these corrupt Merovingian kings. Eventually, with Pepin the Short, he simply says, you know, this is a joke, I'm taking over. So he becomes king, if you like, and his son is Charlemagne.
Charlemagne is interesting because you begin with what some may see as something of a paradox. Charlemagne, the first Holy Roman Emperor, the progenitor of modern Europe, according to some, marks for you not the beginning of the new order, but one final gasp of the old.
In a way, Charlemagne's whole empire was an artificial construct. It was modelled on Rome, but it was thought up in the heads of a couple of clerics. They had this concept in their heads of the order of the Roman Empire. See, this is the ideal that people are striving for all the time. If you live in chaos, you desperately want order, because chaos only benefits thugs, essentially.
Let's describe a picture then of this chaos that comes to full fruition in the time of Charlemagne's grandsons, because they effectively split Europe into the map that we'd recognise loosely today. You have the western lot that becomes France, you have the eastern lot that becomes Germany, and squeezed in the middle you have this wonderful land that we'd recognise today through sort of Holland down through Alsace-Lorraine, Switzerland into Italy, known as Lotharingia.
Named after the Emperor Lothair. The clerics have got this thing in their mind. Charlemagne is an amazing person. He was about 6 foot 4. He's a seriously good warrior, a seriously good soldier. But also he actually worked and worked and worked to learn how to read. He really understood the importance of learning. But he was a Frank at heart. And Franks, they didn't have any concept of primogeniture, that is the eldest son inheriting the empire. So the empire was divided. Well, it was okay for Charlemagne because all his sons died except Louis the Pious. But Louis the Pious, he divided the empire among his sons, which was a recipe for disaster, because you then have three equally ambitious lads. Gradually, throughout the 9th century, centralized government collapses. There is constant civil warfare, essentially, between the sons and between their descendants, so that by the end of the 9th century, Europe is simply in chaos.
But it's in three broad geographic areas, yep, absolutely. This chaos, isn't it?
Yep.
That follow his descendants. So you have the Western Franks, who become what we'd recognise as France.
Exactly.
The Eastern Franks become what we'd later recognise as Germany. And in the middle there, you still have squeezed.
You still have squeezed, but Lotharingia, yes. Yeah. And what's very interesting about that, of course, in 20th century terms, Alsace-Lorraine, you know, became the key area that France and Germany fought over.
They've and been Switzerland doing is French and German, and Holland is the Belgians and the Dutch, the Low Germans.
That's right. The lineaments of Europe are already emerging in the late 9th and early 10th century.
But its lineaments drenched in chaos, and part of the chaos is down to chaos not just with civil structures, but within the church as well. And that's demonstrated both in civil life and in religious life by Rome. Rome is a great exemplar of just what happened.
Yes, it does, because Rome itself was hopelessly divided. What emerged in Rome were a series of warring families, clans, really. Normally, one clan emerges as dominant.
And they captured the papacy as well.
Well, yes, that's exactly right. You see, the popes then became the creatures of the clans. Now, the clan that dominated Rome in the latter part of the 9th and the early part of the 10th century were the Theophylacts. Now, their name tells you they were probably from southern Italy originally.
It's a Greek origin name.
It's a Greek name, yes. And what is most interesting about them, of course, is that there were two very dominant women within the Theophylact clan, of whom Marozia is probably by far the most interesting. She was the mistress of one pope at the age of 14. Talk about sexual abuse. She was the mother of a pope, and she was the grandmother of a pope.
You mentioned the dominance of these clans and the way in which they'd basically, their family priorities swept aside any role for the pope really as a religious leader in any sense, in a practical sense.
Exactly.
But the most horrific example you give, in some ways the most bizarre, is what became known as the Trial of the Dead Pope. Mm. This is Pope Formosus. Now, this is taking revenge in extremis. Just tell us that story.
Well, the Cadaver Synod, it was called. And what happened was that Pope Formosus, who was quite an ascetical man, died at the ripe old age of 84. But he was unbelievably ambitious. And what he was doing was playing off a lot of a local Italian thugs. When he died, the mother of one of those thugs, she decided to get revenge on him. They were actually occupying Rome, not the clans. The clans were in abeyance at this stage. Anyway, so this trial is set up of Pope Formosus because he changed his diocese. He had been the Bishop of Porto, and then he was elected Bishop of Rome. And so,
and you're not supposed to do that.
And you're not supposed to. It was like a bishop was married to his diocese. Anyway, so what they did, they dug up his dead body, put him in full pontifical robes. In fact, the body was probably relatively intact, although it had been in the tomb for 10 months. The stench would have been terrible, and put him on the bishop's seat in St. John Lateran and tried him for heresy. And, of course, he was found guilty. Needless to say, people were very doubtful about his guilt after the basilica collapsed in an earthquake a week after the synod.
We're talking with Paul Collins on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Paul Collins, once an occupant of this chair here on Sunday nights these days, best known as an author and commentator on the Catholic Church and history. And his latest book is The Birth of the West, a look at the chaos of Western Europe at around the lead up to the first millennium, and how modern Europe began to emerge out of that chaos. And that chaos, of course, was shared, and perhaps in part precipitated by what was going on with the church. Paul, you've described for us the chaos that descended on Western Europe after the final crumbling of the Roman Empire and the way in which Rome itself didn't escape this, and particularly the papacy. Let's talk about what some of the pressures were upon this. In the north and the west, you had the Vikings pressing down on this chaos and perhaps precipitating it in some ways. In the east and to the north, you had the Slavs and the Hungarians, the Magyars. In the south, you had the Muslims, the Saracens. And over in the east, to some extent an irritant, the Byzantines, the Byzantine Empire. In a way, they acted to pressure cooker this chaos.
Europe really had collapsed into almost, you might say, its component parts. And what had happened is that local areas were dominated by local thugs.
Because that was all that was left, really, to hold things together.
And that's what always happens in these kind of situations.
Entropy, I think it's called.
It's called so-called brigandage. There are a number of social theories about it, actually. But essentially, the people who were later to become noble families, of course, all began as brigands. They began as thugs. On top of that, you had the pressure of the Vikings. I don't think we can underestimate how barbaric they were. A very good illustration of how barbaric the Vikings could be was a bloke named Ivar the Boneless. Now, nobody quite knows what the bonelessness was about. I mean, he just slaughtered people. And one of his victims was the English king and saint, the Anglo-Saxon king Edmund. You've got the Vikings constantly threatening England and Ireland particularly, and France, because France was very navigable with the rivers, because the Vikings get up the rivers. In the south, in the Mediterranean, you have the Saracen menace. The Saracens constantly threatened the Italian coast.
It came as a surprise to me, and I guess to many, to realise how deep the penetration of the Muslim Arab into Europe was, not just up through Spain and into northern Spain, but into the south of France. Initially, you referred to Charles Martel, but most interestingly, up through Italy, that Naples eventually became a slaving port for the Arab slavers, and the Muslims, the Saracens, even sacked Rome.
Yes, they sacked Rome. In fact, one of the theories is that when they excavated the tomb of St. Peter during the Second World War, and excavated the scavi, the excavations under St. Peter's, which you can now visit, the bones of St. Peter seem to have been scattered, if they are St. Peter's bones, and there is a consensus that they are. That probably happened during a Saracen invasion of Rome, when they sacked the basilica, the old basilica of St. Peter's, which was pulled down in the early 16th century. And the reason why they were penetrated Italy was because Italy was always divided into city-states. And so the city-states used to play each other off. So these central southern ones down towards Naples, they invited the Saracens in as ways of getting a break and fighting each other. They created the southern border. They simply stopped Europeans penetrating any further than the Mediterranean coast, and actually created Europe. The other crowd, who were far less systematic but causing an enormous amount of trouble and penetrated as far as right down into southern Italy, were the Hungarians. And it really wasn't until they were defeated by the Emperor Otto I in the mid-10th century that really their power was broken. They were pushed back and then converted to Christianity.
So it's in this 10th century that those invasive forces began to be restrained.
Exactly.
And initially they're restrained by sort of incidental things, but gradually that restraint becomes more organised. And I'd like to talk about the things that begin to help that organisation in a moment. But first, let's have another tune. And to herald the coming of a new dawn, what better than the Messiah?
Oh,
from the Messiah, a selection of our guest on Sunday night, Paul Collins, author of The Birth of the West, available in your local bookstore. Now, Paul, I said just before, that wonderful music of Handel, that we'd begin to talk about the reemergence of what today is Europe. And the Messiah, I think, is a useful choice because much of this emergence begins to come out of the church. It begins to come out of local monastic communities that are frustrated not just by the collapse of authority of the church, but by the chaos around them. And the key in this is Cluny, a French monastic community founded at the beginning of this period, but it actually comes out of frustration with the lack of not just civil order, but ethical and spiritual order.
I think that even before Cluny, though, you have to go back to the Vikings, because slowly the Vikings settled down. They settled down in Ireland. They settled down in England. In England, it was known as the Danelaw. What happened was that they were converted to Christianity because they married local women. They become part of that bigger entity.
You get then this gradual pacification around the boundaries as they're Christianized. But in the heart of it too, Cluny takes advantage of this in the civil state and introduces something called the peace of God. We've spoken about church reforms, and what's bizarre to our understanding today, and I think it's particularly interesting when I'm speaking to you about the sort of church reforms, because the major reform in purifying and reorganizing the church was in fact celibacy.
Yes.
Might have a slightly different view on the role of celibacy in the church today.
I think you've got to see a celibacy within the kind of social context of the time. We've talked very much about all these thugs who became nobles. And essentially what happened was that they controlled not only the local area, but they also controlled the church in their area. That's why Cluny wanted independence from them, and that's why they linked themselves with the papacy. But these guys actually owned church property. I mean,
I guess they'd give the church some land and say, you can have that as long as we're ultimately the owners.
And and at times clergy gained control, because clergy were married, they gained control of church property and handed it on to their sons. Clergy were married, if that's right. John married.
Wives and children.
Wives and children, yes.
Even popes.
Even popes, yes, before the first millennium. I found this group of clergy who actually had a franchise on a church, essentially, and then the franchise was handed on to their sons. And then the other thing was, of course, that clergy often would marry their daughters to the sons of clergymen. It kept everything within the family. Part of the problem was when the real reform came, the Pope at the time, Gregory VII, he attempted to regain church control of church land, because an enormous amount of church land had been alienated, and also gain control of the life of the clergy. And the notion of celibacy, because monks were celibate, that notion became kind of the model for the model clergyman.
Because it cleans up all the inheritance problems and the legal problems that flow out of that.
Exactly. And on top of that, they even kind of touted a theological justification for it, that the pure body of Christ in the Eucharist came from the pure hands of the celibate clergyman.
And of course, the other thing about this, and I guess it's an argument that has real relevance now, is that the strength of the imposition of celibacy was that it was a real and practical remedy for a demonstrable problem. It wasn't a sacred obligation that was there from eternity to eternity.
No. You're quite right. The spirituality of celibacy, so-called, is stuff that's invented much later on in the 17th century. Someone who I can't not mention is a gentleman who's been touted quite a bit by a number of people in the contemporary sexual abuse crisis of children, and that is St. Peter Damian. Now, Peter Damian was certifiably mad. He's a doctor of the church, by the way. The morals of the clergy were scarcely a high standard at this stage, and those clergy that weren't married were often in homosexual relationships. And in fact, there was great tolerance of homosexuality. I mean, John Boswell's fine book on the history of homosexuality in the West, Boswell points out that this period, from the time of Charlemagne right through to St. Peter Damian, and St. Peter Damian is at the end of the 10th century, in the early 11th century, he's also a key figure actually in the separation between the Eastern and the Western churches. He's a nasty piece of works altogether. He started denouncing the way in which older monks and younger monks were in relationships. And he gets into this diatribe about homosexuality. And he actually makes the statement, and it's quoted in the book, that it would be better, he says, for a man to copulate with a horse than with another man. Now, that's why I say this chap needed a little bit of Freudian therapy, I think.
The other thing that's addressed here that becomes a scandal, and it's linked to the inheritance thing, is the practice of simony.
Yes, buying and selling church offices. And it was widespread and remained widespread right up really till the Council of Trent in the 16th century. But again, you see, it's this kind of materialization of the spiritual. It becomes distorted and the spiritual is lost. And it also comes from the fact that this is a kind of form of popular religion. That is that people had very material notions of the reality of God, of the presence of God, of the presence of demons, of the intercession of the Blessed Virgin.
Still called fundamentalism, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is, but our fundamentalism today is a verbal fundamentalism. Whereas for people there, it was that they believed that nature, the natural world, signified things, that the natural world mirrored, if you like, a spiritual presence. And in some ways, it's a little bit, in my view, at any rate, as a person interested in the environment, a little bit more attractive than but fundamentalism.
But it has its downside. If you spiritualize physical reality, then you can actually trade in it.
That's right, exactly.
It becomes the commodified.
That's the relics trade is exactly that.
Yes. Let's go to another key element in the change. It's just interesting in passing, and this is the attitude to women. The attitude to women is one that actually emerges as quite surprising, and it comes from perhaps an historic understanding of the place of women in religion, which we've lost today.
Yes.
Because there are some quite powerful women in this period.
Oh, absolutely. I mentioned one, Marozia, her mother Theodora and her sister Theodora, another Theodora II. They were in the clans in Rome. But the woman whom I love most is the Empress Theophano, who is a remarkable Byzantine princess who was married off at age 14 to Otto II, the Saxon rulers, and by then Holy Roman Emperor. When he dies as a very young man at 28, after a happy marriage together, this is a woman who had been brought up as a child speaking Greek, had learnt classical and vulgar Latin, was able to converse easily, but also learnt Low and High German, was the regent for Otto III, her young son, who became emperor at the age of 3. Just a remarkable woman, a great administrator. She was very wise. She had very good bishops advising her, very shrewd operator.
There were a number, linked to her too, a number of key women who were abbesses,
yes,
in their own right. And this is interesting in your book, that the role of the abbess seems to have been equated very much to the equivalent of a priest or a bishop,
yes,
in some circumstance,
exactly,
even to the extent of the exercise of ministry.
Well, there's a fine new book by a guy named Gary Macy, an American teaching in a Jesuit university in California. Macy's book shows that these abbesses, in fact, within their own communities, fulfill priestly roles. There's no doubt that they offered absolution in terms of the sacrament of penance, at least to their own subjects and to people who lived on their lands, not just to the nuns, but to the people who lived on their lands. And they had what today would be described as ordinary jurisdiction, that is, a jurisdiction which came to govern the church in their own territories. Many of these women, especially in the German lands, were in fact princesses. They were sisters of the emperor. All of them are extraordinarily impressive figures. All of them wise, grounded, sensible women. The other key issue I think that's operative is the adoption of Roman law. And in Roman law, women could hold land, and land property was money. But there is no doubt that in the early Middle Ages, women were in far better shape socially and in terms of society than in the latter Middle Ages.
We're coming to the end of our journey, and we've got to draw some threads together, and I've left the one integrating thread out of this discussion, but you've mentioned one of its heroic figures, or the Ottonians, that is the East Franks, the people who became the Saxons, and these were the people who actually, out of that chaos, first began to introduce some order and recreated what, down to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, became
the Holy Roman
Empire.
Yep. It's interesting, the Saxons were only two generations from conversion by Charlemagne. Charlemagne slaughtered 5,000 surrendered Saxon troops on one day in order to force Christianity on the Saxons. So this is a group of people who were forced converted and sacrificed much because they had a semi-democratic structure. But they then emerge as the champions of Christianity and the champions of order in government. In fact, I say in the book, my subtitle in a way should really be How the Germans Saved Civilization, because they did. Because the advantage that the Saxons had, as they became the dominant lord in Germany, their great advantage was that there were only seven or eight other families or clans that challenged them. So they just had to keep them on side. The way that they kept them on side was by constant travel, because the presence of the king symbolized his authority. So his authority was real when he was there. And he processed around the kingdom by set routes, and the local yokels had to make sure the roads were in good shape, because about 1,000 people would have travelled with the king, including an archive. Because how do they keep track of where they'd given property to people, you see? These Saxon kings, Otto the First is the greatest of them.
And the Ottos eventually fuse a compact with Rome. Yep. That enables modern Europe to eventually emerge.
Exactly, because they are given the title Holy Roman Emperor. There are two powers in Christendom. On the one hand, there is the imperial power, on the other hand, the papal power. This is called the Gelasian theory, the theory of Pope Gelasius. And Gelasius' intention was that these two powers sat equally with each other. Well, he was an optimist, wasn't he? The reaction to that comes in the 11th century, where you have a series of reforming popes who then challenge the emperor. That brings then the great constitutional crisis between the papacy and the empire, which dominates continental Europe throughout, really, the High Middle Ages.
The one other thing, and you finish with this, that we should appropriately finish with too, is the legacy out of wrestling both with the church and the world and spirituality is here. You point to the beginnings of the idea of the individual self.
Exactly. Yes.
And that it blossoms in the Renaissance. But
yes.
Here is where it begins.
We think that, you know, it was the Renaissance literary figures that brought us the notion of the individual, and that prior to that people were just cogs in a big community, and that they had no identity separate from the community. But in a way, what monasticism does is it takes people out of the broader community into a community, certainly, but in that community each individual has a relationship with God. Each individual contributes to the building up of the fabric of the monastic community. And slowly that idea, individual ethical responsibility, gradually starts to grow. And people start to say, well, you know, I don't just do what everybody does. I may well have to challenge that sometimes. I may well have to stand up. Now, it was very, very difficult to do that, especially for a lower class person, a peasant, almost impossible for them in the Middle Ages.
You have an obligation.
But of course, but not impossible for a peasant, because the greatest pope of all the popes, in my view, the greatest genius ever to be pope, was Sylvester II, a man named Gerbert of Aurillac in southern France. Been to Aurillac. They make umbrellas there now in France. Funny little town, really. But Gerbert really comes from peasant stock. We don't know who his parents were, but a monastic education in Aurillac gave him the wherewithal. He then went to Spain. He was the man who brought what we call Arabic numerals. That's the 1 to 9. He didn't have zero, but kind of worked out an abacus computer on the floor of Reims Cathedral when he was archbishop there. And he used a space for zero, which, of course, is exactly what zero is, I suppose. He's the man who brings Arabic science, medicine, knowledge of astronomy. He built a basic telescope. He was an expert on music. He was a genius. He and Otto the Third, who he'd been Otto's tutor, they had a notion of re-establishing the Roman Empire, but they all died too young.
And the rest, as they say,
is histoire.
Before you go, you didn't write this without some sense of present reality. France's faces a present reality. You outlined several things which are critical. We mentioned reform of the church and the way in which sexuality was at the centre of it. Again, we're at a pivotal point where sexuality is at the centre of it. Reform then consisted in introducing celibacy.
If the church, the Catholic Church, is going to maintain its ministry, reform now consists in at least ordaining married men, and of absolutely without any doubt considering the ordination of women. It took a couple of hundred years to reform the medieval church in the 10th century. It's going to probably take that now. But I think you put your finger on one of the key issues, which is the issue of sexuality. That is that the kind of sexuality that Christianity has inherited comes really essentially from late Roman Platonism, the body-soul dualism, the body bad, the soul good. It comes from kind of figures like St. Peter Damian, a kind of denouncing sexuality with very crude notions of sexuality.
And very tough Augustinianism.
And very tough Augustinian notions. Now, I think that we have got to rethink sexuality within Christianity, but entirely in the light of the fact that we live in a totally different world, a world dominated by psychology, by Freudianism, by all of the notion of the individual, individual rights, all of those issues. So, yeah, Pope Francis has got a job ahead of him.
And history, an aid, not an enemy.
That's what I think, but at least he doesn't have to deal with the clans.
Paul Collins, thanks so much for coming along and sharing with us tonight on Sunday night. Let's end with a little popular culture, something reflective of a different century, another world entirely. Bing Crosby.
Now don't think I'm bold, but my mother told me to love thy neighbor, and you will find your labor a great deal easier. Life will be breezier if you love thy neighbor.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S. Thank you for listening.